Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 731. At Midnight is on at 11 o'clock for the next couple of weeks.
That's really confusing.
Shut up.
At 11.
No, it's at midnight. At 11 o'clock.
At 11 night.
Ooh, at 11 night. Ooh, hashtag at 11 night.
No, it's not 11 night. It is at midnight, still at 11. We're going to be back at midnight as soon as Trevor Noah takes over the Daily Show in a couple weeks. But we're doing a week in a couple weeks called Bunches of Funches. Ron
like
Funches will
going.
Be on every
yeah!
day.
Yeah! Oh, they got all our letters.
That's in 2 weeks. Yeah, like in a week and a half.
Dear at midnight.
Yeah.
Anytime you don't have Ron Funches on, I think, where's Ron Funches? Is he behind the desk? Is he going to be in the audience as
there?
A plant?
I know. When people
that would be great.
Did he get lost?
Audience?
You know, sometimes when I'll go on the road and I'll talk to people in the audience and they'll go, where's Ron Funches? I'm like, I don't carry him around in a Bjorn. Like, well, I don't know where he is. He's a grown up.
What
he's
if
off,
you did?
He's off doing his own thing.
Your life would be
thing.
Hilarious?
I guess it would be.
It's like a fun buddy cop movie where neither of you are cops?
Nope. But yes, we're going to do that. I think we might do a 90s themed episode too.
Ooh.
Coming up. So we got some fun stuff on the At Midnight program. But what do you guys have in the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
The LA Podfest is coming up next weekend. It's in Beverly Hills at the Sofitel Hotel, September 18th through the 20th. And we have a bunch of shows there. We have Thrilling Adventure Hour, Dining with Doug and Karen, Indoor Kids, and The Todd Glass Show. And you can find out info and get tickets at lapodfest.com.
Yes, unfortunately, I will not be attending, but because fortunately, I'll be performing in Texas.
I think I'm going to try to go this year. I keep saying
it's
I'm going to
so
go.
So much fun.
And the saddest thing is I think the reason I'm going to go is because I want to see the Giant Bomb guys do something live because they're the best.
What do you got on the corkboard?
I've got a fella sent in. His name's Colby Wells. And he started an Instagram called Alliteration_Nation. And it's all single image pieces that are alliterative words that also teach you speech therapy and build your vocabulary.
Well, you know, my problem with that is that it sounds like using Instagram for something constructive.
Yeah, it's
and
like vaguely
educational. I just want pictures of, you know, like...
What if I were to tell you he put filters over them? Would that make it okay?
Okay, which ones?
All your favorites?
All your favorites. Well done. You're pro Levine.
Have you followed Socality Barbie?
I have not.
It's fucking great. Someone basically it's the opposite of that, but it's a satire. Okay? But it's someone that has pictures of it's Barbie and all these Instagram pictures, but it's the amalgam of every annoying Instagram ever. So it's just like, you know, her and it's Barbie in front of like salt and straw ice cream saying like living my authentic life. And there's like 50 hashtags. So it's Socality Barbie. It's
my brother whose Instagram I don't know because I'm not good at Instagram, just does pictures of our dog and princess coffee cups at our house. That's all his Instagram is. It's just different pictures. So, and then on Fridays, it's
name?
Both. I think it's at Fink Fink Santiago.
But
it's Casey Clark.
Name?
KASEYCLARK.
All right.
So you can search there. Look for the one with all the princess mugs and dogs. Yeah.
What are you reading?
The Socality Barbie. It's amazing.
She's the worst.
Which one do you have?
I saw
a coonskin cap while hiking.
Yeah, she's like in
that.
The woods and went for a walk in the woods this morning. Couldn't resist the urge to put plant life in front of my face. And then seriously.
Oh, I'm so full of hate.
Hashtag live folk. Hashtag kinfolk. Hashtag
won't.
Let's go somewhere. Hashtag get outside.
Don't go somewhere. Hashtag no.
God, this is really like everyone I hate in the world.
It's really funny. It's like they've done such a good, whoever's doing it has done such an amazing job of the authenticity of it is spot on.
Well, those people should follow alliteration_nation to do some good for the Instagram and learn stuff.
Of course I will, Kyle, and your brother Casey. This episode is Ed Zwick and Tobey Maguire. They're promoting Pawn Sacrifice, which is all about Bobby Fischer. I played competitive chess in school. I know all about Bobby Fischer. His story is sad and fascinating. And so there's a couple of good Bobby Fischer documentaries out there.
There are. There's a couple that just hit Netflix sort of in time with this that are real good.
If you want to watch a brilliant mind slowly unravel
and then have opinions
illness,
on the Jews.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
Katie laughed. It's fine.
Anyway, they're promoting Pawn Sacrifice in theaters Wednesday, September 16th. And I think they did a pretty good job not geeking out on Tobey Maguire too much about Spider-Man. Bled through just a little bit.
You got
so
a little
I apologize,
bit.
But I feel like I was able to rein it back in. I did my best.
You didn't point and scream, Spider-Man, when he walked in.
No, I did not.
So that's
I did
good.
Not. Hi, friendly neighborhoods. But yeah, I didn't dangle upside down in front of him, which I'm sure people do a lot of time for that old chestnut. But anyway, they were great guests. And here we go. The Nerds Podcast number 731 with Ed Zwick and Tobey Maguire.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Like I knew you when I was many, many, many years ago.
We did know each other many years ago.
Raphael. I love that.
I can't believe you remember that.
Yeah.
I was going to mention it, and I was expecting you to be like, the fuck are you talking about?
It was funny because I was trying to remember her last name. I was like, Lisa, what was it?
Yes.
Raphael, yeah.
Lisa Raphael, yeah. It was when I was like 22, Lisa was probably 19, and she was in a friend group. It was Toby and like Leo and Jay Ferguson and Kevin Connolly. Yeah. And
that is
like
that group.
we're the same crew.
That's awesome. I see Jay Ferguson every once in a while, and it's great to see. It's just really nice to see like everyone went off and actually
had a life. Yeah.
Did some great stuff.
Yeah,
but I haven't talked to Lisa in ages. I heard she's married, and I think she has a kid, but it's been it's been years. So good job on everything working out. I mean, it seems like I feel like this acting thing is working out quite well for you at this point.
So some ups and downs.
And then the other thing that I'll say is my very first paid gig was an episode of 30 Something.
Come on,
I was a delivery boy and I had like one line, but it was the episode right after Gary died.
Well, guess what?
What?
Brad Pitt's first thing had one line in an episode, so you're in good company.
Well, I'm not sure we're still in the same track.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought maybe that was sort of inevitable.
It's very close.
Uh-huh, okay.
I mean, it's like the difference between human and chimpanzee DNA. It's like 99.98%, but a little more in Brad's favor.
Love that.
At that point.
After Gary died, wow.
Right, yeah. And so they were, and then Ken Olin's character was cleaning out all the... Mm-hmm. I watched the show. I remember how it went. But I know you guys are doing press. You might be in press junket mode. This is a very loose conversation. There's no.
Hey, I really dig what you guys do here. I really do.
Oh,
I
do.
I actually listen to it.
So oh, you do.
I do.
So you totally know.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
I'm very happy to hear that. I do, however, I am so blown away that you did a movie about Bobby Fischer. I was a lifelong chess player. I grew up chess club. Fischer Spassky was always a big deal, and this story does it all around just the events of the match, or does it follow? Like, does it go later into his life where he completely flies off the handle?
It describes the childhood and then jumps mostly to Reykjavik, but we also talk about as a kind of denouement what happened to him,
right?
And so the seeds of the demise are contained within the drama that's there.
Right.
Yeah.
There's always a sort of interesting point with him, which is how, and something that I'm actually really fascinated by is how closely tied is genius to essentially mental illness, that they seem to be inextricably linked because they, when you sort of look at a lot of the really great grandmasters, a lot of them didn't end up doing too well.
mentally. Do you think there's a connection between those two? Do you think there's a causality? Is it too much chest sort of breeds that? Or do you think a certain personality type is attracted to it?
Do you want to go with that one?
I don't think that it's actually linked. I think that, and I think, see, we've had many conversations about it, and in particular around Bobby Fischer, and we have touched on some of the other chess players. But see, we could get in a debate, and I could switch sides of the debate about whether chess actually sort of held off Bobby Fischer's mental health demise, because it kept him occupied.
That's
he
true.
Was occupied for many, many hours every day and focused on a goal. I think as he got close to this world championship, and sometimes when he went to go face competitors, I think he was extremely competitive, really wanted to win. I think he had a fear of losing, but also a fear of winning. And if you look at what happens is after the world championship, it's a pretty quick and steep descent for Bobby. So to me, it was sort of like there was nothing left, and he didn't have that same preoccupation. Mm. So I could argue that side, but I could flip on the other side as well of the argument. So, I don't have a conclusion.
I think somebody once said that every man has his addiction, but some choose the wrong one.
Right.
And I think it's not entirely clear whether he chose chess or it chose him, because he was so gifted in this thing that he was fated to follow this particular pursuit that inevitably led you into this utterly introspective, isolated, self-contained universe. And if you have other mental issues as he did, I think there was maybe some kind of resonance back and forth, like gasoline and matches.
Sure.
That maybe conspired to be synergistic in that way.
I mean, his childhood was really fucked up.
It was big time fucked up.
It's like he didn't know who his dad was, or he thought his dad was one person, and then it turned out it was another guy, and his mom was...
But in fact, he knew the guy was his dad, but didn't know he was his dad.
Didn't know he was his dad until he was like nine, and his mom was...
Yeah.
And his mom was an activist, and the CIA had a big file on her, but every time they would interview her, you'd be like, she seems a little... I don't know. It didn't really feel like a super warm household to grow up in.
Yeah, I think... And I do think that his mother did care about him, but... had other interests and things pulling at her attention. She was an intellectual. She spoke many different languages. She was somehow involved with the Communist Party, would leave Bobby at a young age in the apartment that the neighbor is next door. Like I think probably, and I'm speculating to some degree, but probably made sure the neighbor was next door and knew that Bobby was there, but then would leave her 9-year-old kid, which is also, but in that era, wasn't as unthinkable as it is today.
But I've also known a lot of people who were red diaper babies, and their parents cared a lot about the people, but less about people.
What's a red diaper baby?
They were the children of communists.
And they
believed in
red diapers.
Yeah, they believed in mankind.
Sure,
but weren't so preoccupied with men. I mean, it was a sense that their mission and the commitment to the saving of the world in at times of dire need was more important than the actual tending and care of those around them.
Well, it was a much broader, almost like philosophical socialism, where like, oh, for all of them. What about your own kid? Well, we're all.
Yeah,
I know, but your kid's freaking out. But I have to stop the war.
That's right.
And then with Bobby, I think at 6 or 7, he discovers chess and some other games. And it was, in my mind, I think we probably are closely aligned on this, Ed, that chess was a reprieve for Bobby, like a place that was safe for him. And he didn't like games that had any element of chance, because it wasn't as pure. There's less control, and something could come intervene. And I think part of that is just strictly competitive. It was frustrating, like sure. if somebody rolled dice or something like that, and then it thwarted your advantage. But he also talked about the purity of essentially the exchange or communication over the chessboard.
Right. I mean, it's this idea that his home life seemed relatively unstable, but, you know, then you can focus on something that you feel like you have complete control over. I just remember having to give up competitive chess because it was driving me crazy. And kids in competitive chess are like, when I look back, I much rather would have been punched in the chest by a jock because at least the bruise heals. But the psychological warfare of sitting across from some fucked up 9-year-old who's just trying to pierce into your soul and, you know, analyze.
Well, I mean, when I think about great athletes, and chess is a sport, when you really get to know anybody who is at that level, the one constant is mental toughness.
Mm-hmm.
That ability to retain focus and concentration over long, intense periods. And whether that's Michael Jackson in the fourth quarter of a game when you're already exhausted and he's going to raise the level of his game, or two tennis players going into the fifth set of a match someplace, that's also what you're talking about. Sure. In terms of that kind of amazing, amazing capability.
I also love the documentaries that I've seen about Bobby Fischer. It's funny when you see the footage because it really did represent such an interesting Cold War era battle between the Soviets and the United States. But seeing old footage of like ABC's Wide World of Sports, World Chess Championship, seems hilarious to me that, you know, that we were so entrenched in chess that it was being covered, you know, on regular, they were interrupting television programming to bring you chess coverage.
And then saying, in other news, Vietnam today.
yeah, right. Yeah. But, I mean, I wonder if some of that was also, you know, how much Bobby Fischer, obviously kind of being in his own universe, do you think he really took on the weight of, you know, the United States versus the Soviets? I feel like that wouldn't have really meant that much to him.
I don't think so. I think Bobby was aware of the attention and aware of, to some degree, I want to say the importance put on the match, and then used it as leverage to negotiate for better conditions and more money. That's how I think it played into his you know, consciousness and his tactics moving forward.
Yeah, because they were saying you know, his people who were close to him, because he kept stalling the match. No one knew if he was going to show up. And Spassky was in Iceland for like 9 days just waiting. Bobby Fischer never showed up. He'd go to the airport, leave, go back. And, you know, one of his friends said, I don't think it was a tactic to try to fuck with Spassky. He just literally couldn't. He just kept getting scared. He just
I think it's a combination of fear and not. It's not that he was negotiating by going to the airport and then leaving. I think he would be genuinely bothered that something wasn't just the way he wanted it to be, which I think, you know, that it was his particular way he would process things and the control he wanted, which is sort of coupled with an underlying, you know, kind of fear in terms of the way you function. And then I think he was also afraid of finally meeting Spassky in that moment as well.
I have to ask you a dumb question, and I apologize, but I'm always fascinated by this, which is, as an actor, when you are portraying someone who might not be totally stable, do you have a weird fear like, fuck, what if I discover I'm not stable, or what if I can't shake it off? Like, are you able to separate?
I've made that discovery.
Oh, you have?
I'm not stable. No.
And you're comfortable with it. You're
no, good. You know, I think mental health is a very interesting topic because it is not – there's not a clear line where, you know, if you're left of the line, you're, you know, considered to have a problem. If you're right of the line, I mean – We judge this based on our perception of people's behaviors, and then we cluster those behaviors together and then give diagnosis to people, right?
Yeah.
Like you have this disorder or that disorder. And to me, we're all on the spectrum somewhere.
Everyone I know, me, like everyone has some type of like, oh, I'm really anxious, or I'm depressed, or I'm not this, or I'm dissociative, or like there's always the stigma of mental illness. I think needs to be, you know, like I think we as a culture just need to go, you know, everyone's got a little something.
Yeah.
And so how do we, you know, what is normal? Like, what is normal?
Well, it's also when you evoked what his childhood was like, I think whatever the currency is of your life as a kid, I don't think that's causal. But as you, if you become obsessive, if you have any kind of disorder, I think the nomenclature, the what you seize on, might have to do with what your frame of reference is. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was surveilled, the fact that there might have been some sort of incipient paranoid world around him, that's something that you would go back. We all have. It's like comfort food. What are your tastes? What are your patterns of attraction? It's all formed in some young age. I don't think it makes you marry the person that you marry, sure, but it has had an effect on the girls you've been attracted to throughout your life.
Right.
Yeah, and we're conditioned by all of our circumstances, right? So, yeah. So you have your early circumstances, and then you go meet the bigger world, and the bigger world then suggests different ways to behave. But if in fact you then don't evolve from there,
right?
Right? And Bobby, I think, was largely shaped in those early years,
exactly,
and didn't move forward.
Yeah.
You know, and again, partially. So this, we could get back into the chess part of this, which
the repetitions
is
he, and the patterns.
Well, yeah, but he also had chess. So as he went to school or interface with the larger community where people socialize and change their behaviors and what is normal, Bobby would retreat into chess.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it might have
encouraged.
Helped him not. Made it possible for him not to confront those issues and socialize and evolve in that way.
But also, there is what you're also suggesting, though, is that there's something regressive in a thing to which he attached at a very young age. So not surprising that he might hearken back to some of the feelings and the ambient universe that surrounded that.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Because I wonder how aware of himself he was. Because when you look at the Fischer-Spassky match, I think it was Game 6. He throws out this entirely weird new. He was very. His openings were very predictable. Like, he did the same thing time and time again. People always knew. And then all of a sudden, at a brilliantly strategic time, he throws Spassky totally off balance by opening with this other, I think, kind of obscure British opening that he never did. And it. Spassky didn't know how to deal with it because they expected him to do the same thing every time.
Yeah, and it seems to me, Bobby, you know, was strategic as far as the game goes, and likely worked on that opening and that sequence, knowing that they would not have prepared for that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's a smart guy and knows how predictable he is, and that's, I think, it's probably a ton of work to go work on in a direction that you haven't worked in before, but he was not afraid of working.
Did anyone ever, I'm sure there must be documentaries about Spassky, but going back to Russia after losing, after forfeiting the last match, I mean, what was that poor guy's life like after that?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's very interesting in that when the Soviet Union broke up, he chose actually to come to the West.
Mm-hmm.
He had a wife and family back there, so it was inevitable that he would go back. They were very afraid that, you know, of defection, but he was not about to. I don't know what happened to him literally upon his return. He continued to play chess, and he actually was in this remarkable kind of generosity of one sportsman to another, continued to be very good to Bobby Fischer, even in his decline.
Right. Yeah, because Garry Kasparov also came over.
Yeah.
He now lives in the States.
Yeah.
You know, he's a big human rights advocate.
You bet.
And so it's interesting to see, like, some of those guys got out of a situation that seemed maybe not great mm-hmm. for them, especially when so much of, you know, so much of your regime's identity is based upon whether or not you're gonna beat someone
at
chess.
Well, Toby already described Bobby, I think, correctly as being somewhat of the reluctant gladiator, and I think Spassky was similar. I think these were two great sportsmen who looked upon this as an opportunity for their personal ambition and the sport, but not as sort of representative, you know, out for the ideologies of their respective countries.
Did you talk to any of the guys who are currently playing, like Magnus Carlsen or anyone? Did you have any conversations with any chess dudes?
No, we're hoping to meet him. Actually, we're going to meet him next week.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now we can watch firsthand to see how he holds up over the years. Like, let's keep an eye on him.
That's right.
To see how he's doing. I'm really interested to hear how. So, you know, we were barely kind of acquaintance when we were essentially teenagers. And then how did you survive the valley? You know, like, how did you... I mean, it can be a toxic place with a toxic... I don't mean, you know, like, the physical valley, but I just mean the sort of mentality of, like, you know... actor kid, you know, there's a lot of different ways that could have gone.
Yeah.
So how did you stay focused, and what started, you know, like what really helped you find your path?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I you know, just put one foot in front of the other and kept moving forward, have good friends. And I always wanted to work, though. I like to work. And if I don't know, distractions would get too distracting, then I would get rid of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have any, you know, secret ingredients for that. Just go forward.
I think that is actually a pretty good ingredient. I mean, it might seem not like to you, it's what you did, so you might not think that's a. But honestly, like, you know, having clear goals and staying on your path and not getting too distracted, I think that actually is really...
How about yourself?
How did I get out of it? I didn't for a while. I got sober like 12 years ago, but I
did that too.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That was there too.
Tremendously helpful. Right, yeah. Tremendously helpful. And I don't think... Do you ever sometime... How long has it been for you?
20 years.
20 years. Wow, that's amazing. Do you ever think back on what the alternate universe Tobey Maguire is doing? Like, sometimes I have weird dreams about, like, oh my god, that other Chris Hardwick is fucking dead somewhere on a beach. Like, do you ever?
I've definitely pondered it, and it's you know, I've also had throughout the years, as I'm sure you have too, where you have friends that you were very much doing similar things and. You know, you got out and they didn't, and I've watched a handful of people that I was, you know, friends or friendly with die or have really rough lives.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm always. Do you ever have friends who reach out and go, "Hey, man, I'm kind of thinking about quitting, and it seems like it worked for you." I mean, do you have
on occasion? Yeah, on occasion.
I kind of like those experiences because I feel like. Then I feel like all the fucking up was not for no reason, that it actually – that someone else can benefit from the – was there just a general feeling of, oh, I should probably get my life on track and focus? Was that ultimately what it was for you?
yeah. I mean, I had some experiences that were, you know, shouting to me pretty loudly. But I was 19 when I got sober.
Wow.
And there was a general sense of, I want to be productive. I want to go towards my goals. I want to live a great life for myself. And I keep getting derailed and I'm self-destructive to a degree. And it's frustrating and I don't want to just be stuck. I want to move forward.
Yeah.
That was the general feeling.
I think it's great. And I think it's so impressive that at 19 you made that decision. It took me, I was like 31 by the time. I had to go through all my 20s before I was like, oh yeah, don't do this. Don't do this anymore. One of the things I think is so remarkable about what you do, Ed, is the sort of back and forth between television and film. Mm-hmm. Do they both scratch a different itch for you? It's like, I kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, I think at an early moment that was considered odd. I think now it's become the norm. I think what's interesting is that for me it was, you know, do you like dogs or do you like cats? And the answer is I really like them both.
You like both.
Yeah, and I think there was an opportunity in television because it was such a writer's medium at the time. As movies increasingly became less of that, to really go deeper into behavior and character and dialogue, some of the things that I really love, as movies became louder and brighter and, you know, bigger and faster, that I think that there was an opportunity to look at what was epic in a small life, and indeed in movies what was small in more epic lives. So I think it was sort of this odd kind of vibration back and forth between the two things. They each expressed aspects of who I wanted to be as a storyteller, but also maybe who I was as a person.
Sure. Have you ever thought about, does television ever, because television is basically like the new indie film in a weird sort of way. Have you ever thought about finding a good series?
Yeah, I'm developing some things now in film and TV, and I just like good storytelling, and wherever the collaborators I'm excited to work with are going. The only thing for me is because a lot of production is outside of LA, I think it would be difficult for me to sign up for something that had the potential of going, for multiple number of
sure.
years.
Well, outside because
of
you've got
LA.
Young kids.
Yeah, because I have
and,
kids.
And I was lucky enough at the time to be raising kids here when production was here.
Oh, yeah.
So that actually for me, making movies was not just a way to be home and coach soccer and drive carpool, but it also was a way to then try to have the time to develop the movies that I really wanted to make and not sure. to have to take a job. And in the most practical sense, it provided cash flow.
Right.
I was able to live from one movie to the next, which were very difficult to accomplish. And so it was a bit of a business plan as well.
Do you how old are your kids now?
8 and 6.
Oh, wow. Does that happen when you have kids? Did you think you would ever want to have kids? And when you had them, did the magical thing happen where you're like, I can't believe I never thought about doing this before? Or did you always want a family?
I always had a sense that I would have kids and that I would have a family. I had my first child when I was 31, which was a little earlier than I had been thinking previously. But of course, it's fantastic, and they're the best things that I've done or been a part of. And it's really challenging, and within the challenge, it is a lot of reward as well.
Yeah.
Personally, I mean, other than them, and they're phenomenal, but I mean, for myself, the demands it puts on you as a person, which again is difficult, but it's such an opportunity to, grow.
Yeah. Have you shown them Spider-Man yet? Would you show them your work?
I would. And one of my kids watched a little bit of it and didn't want to watch it because it was a little scary for them.
Oh, I would imagine if they did they not.
They, I don't, they don't, they don't love violence in movies.
Sure.
So, and those movies have some violence. So,
yeah.
They just don't like watching that stuff. And they know about movie making, and I talk to them about, how it gets made and what it is, but I actually like it because I'd rather them not watch that stuff right now and kind
sure.
of keep the innocence and look at it in a little more of a realistic sense. But I do explain what's actually happening as well.
They understand that you're pretending to be other people and that it's not real and it's
yeah,
not really
you. Yeah,
but
just their impression, their like emotional reaction and their impression of it is too strong, so.
I guess that's true. Because that was one of the movies that completely changed everything in nerd culture and brought it out from being this sort of niche thing to,
it's true.
Spider-Man and X-Men were the two movies that really like, oh, these are viable genres that can be told really beautifully and be really cool. And I don't think of that movie as being violent or scary, but I guess if you're 6 or 8, Willem Dafoe got like, that's, I guess that would be pretty horrifying if you
yeah.
were a kid.
Yeah.
But, at the time, did you realize that you were sort of helping to bring what had previously in the 90s not an amazing genre into the forefront?
Well, I wasn't, on its surface, I didn't I wasn't interested in the project at first because of what you're talking about, because of the sort of perception of the genre and where that had been mostly historically. There are, you know, I think the Superman movies, I think particularly 1 and 2, I really enjoyed and thought they were very well done. And, you know, Richard Donner is a very talented director, and Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder, and, you know, there's good people and there are good stories, and I enjoy those movies. So it existed before, but the current trend was not towards – I don't want to say not trying to make good movies, because I think mostly people are trying to make good movies, but it just wasn't what was happening.
I think you also have to think about Alvin. Right.
Oh,
and
no.
Laura and these extraordinary artists, but that's why
why I did it, because once I started meeting the people who were involved, and the first script was David Koepp, and then Alvin Sargent wrote the second movie, and Laura Ziskin, the producer, and Sam Raimi, when I started talking to them about what they wanted to do with the film, that's when I got excited and ultimately joined up with them to make it, because they wanted to make a character-based movie that was about that and the kind of superhero action sequences were really coming out of character.
Yeah.
That was the aim anyways.
I remember when that movie came out and people were like, wow, Tobey Maguire, he's like a serious actor. And I said to people, like, I know, but I knew him when he was a kid, and he's totally this guy. And if I didn't you used to have like glasses? Didn't you used to have like big glasses when you were a kid?
I remember there was a time when I'm trying to think through like what I feel comfortable saying and not saying, but I was going somewhere that was like, you know, kind of an exclusive sort of place, and you know, there's a door person you got to get through. And I was with a friend who was bringing me, and I was wearing this old ratty pink T-shirt with holes, sweatpants, glasses with tape on the side, and I was a stoner kid.
Yeah.
And I also had an attitude of like, well, if they don't accept me for who I am, then I'm not going to go in there. And I had my friends begging me, like, please just like put on some somewhat presentable clothes, because it just becomes my problem, because I have to talk them into letting you in. And I go, you know, I just didn't think it was right to not allow me in because of what I decided to wear.
Yeah. Why don't they get you, man?
Yeah.
So you're not going to accept me. Fuck you.
I remember also early days in the business when I started getting invited to, you know, do photo shoots or premieres or different kinds of events. And I remember thinking, like, if I ever go to the Oscars, I'm going to wear shorts and no makeup. And if I got zits, then fuck them. Right? And then you start seeing all these like good looking people on the cover of magazines and you go, wow, I'm really going to stand out.
Yeah. And also, as much as you're like, well, this is just how I am, you also don't want that to be your complete identity. You would be that guy. Like, oh, here comes Tobey Maguire. And the fucking holes in the shirts.
Right.
Every time. But I'm sure you hear about it a lot because I, you know, obviously it was, those movies were so huge, but your Peter Parker was such a great, you were so grounded and not aware. Like, you were not aware that you were playing a superhero. You were perfect. You were just so great. And I hope you appreciate
Thank you.
The impact that those movies had and that character, even though they keep rebooting them for licensing reasons. But I really do think, I don't care how many fucking Brits try to come over here and take that crown. But I really do hope that you realize that to a huge multi-generational sector of our culture, you are the definitive Peter Parker. And I hope you understand that.
Thank you. It was fun to do them.
In addition to, you know, when you got past that, was it scary at all or nerve-wracking or, oh, I can't wait to go do other stuff. I want to be able to go do other stuff.
Yeah, they were very time-consuming in the making of them and the prep and the promoting. So over something like a 9-year period, I was only able to do, I think, two other films outside of those movies. something like that. I have to go back and count on my fingers, but I think I did Seabiscuit and The Good German in between, one and two, and then two and three. I was itching to have more opportunities to go do other things. I had a blast, and it was a great team. But again, it was just so time consuming.
Sure. How's your process changed now when you're picking roles versus, you know, when you first started?
I would say it's mostly a feel thing, and I think that's been the same for me throughout my whole career. I mean, there are things where I'm considering who it is that I, do I want to work with the team involved in this? Do I like the story? But it really just adds up to a feel thing, even in those sort of that sort of analysis, like, do I appreciate the movies that person makes, what they're about? Do I like this story, this character? Do I ultimately feel compelled to go work on it?
Yeah. Did you guys know each other before you started working on this?
I think peripherally, I think we really met through Leo.
Yeah.
When I was making Blood Diamond.
Yeah.
And I knew what good friends they were, and Leo would often talk about his childhood, and he would talk about Toby. He would talk about him very fondly, but also very comically, and as you can imagine, but that means a lot. That when you connect with someone and they really talk about someone with as much fondness and great love that with which he spoke about Toby, I somehow intuitively understood that this was a good person and a serious person and an artist. And the funny thing is that those recommendations, as you're hoping to work with, whether it's a DP or a designer, there is, that kind of honor among thieves. We do talk to each other trying to ask about people because it's a very close and intimate and high stakes relationship that you're going into. You're putting your trust in someone that you don't necessarily know.
Sure.
And you want the experience to be of a certain kind, not just in terms of its execution, which is most important, but also its process.
Right.
Because this is your life. And as Toby's describing, 9 years, that defines your life. You're spending more time there than you are with your family or in your home. And so you're saying to yourself, well, what will the nature of my experience be?
Right.
So when there was the possibility of us working together, that was in my mind. It didn't cause it, but I think it informed something for me.
Yeah, it is important, I think, because it doesn't matter how successful or famous or anything, if you're a dick, sooner or later, people are not going to work with you if they don't have to.
And believe me, there's a rap. There's just a kind of way that people refer to someone in this code in which you want to run screaming in the other direction, because with me, it's usually defined by a certain lack of gratitude.
Sure.
That there are those people who just, for whatever reason, are in some kind of pain or deprivation, and they want to act that out in some public circumstance, because the movie business will give you license to misbehave.
Yes.
And there's nobody who's regulating that or governing it. And if you find yourself in a situation with somebody who's abusing it, it's very painful.
Yeah, you're right. It is definitely enabled in this business, but I feel like it can't last for too, I mean, maybe in a couple of cases, but I feel like it can't last
right.
for
it's
too
all,
long.
Right, it's all tied to dollars and cents.
You right.
know, if they're the driver of vehicles that are making lots of money, unfortunately, nobody will, or not nobody, I mean, maybe there's an individual, but by and large, they'll go unchecked.
Yeah.
And that, in a way, is encouraging that behavior. Then it starts to tie into them, I think, and obviously I'm speaking generally, but they might start thinking that's part of their secret sauce for success.
Right, yeah.
Right, yes, because people make associations.
Yeah, right.
But also, I mean, there are enough hurdles that life will throw at you. Why create more right. when and, everyone's just when and, everyone's coming together
and,
just trying
and
to make
there
something?
There is a karmic wheel.
Sure.
I do believe that it turns, and we've been around long enough to see it turn.
You've seen it turn
a few times,
yeah.
I have.
And interestingly, it sort of dovetails back into Bobby Fischer and just that story, there's a great story about
I think maybe it was game two or game – no, it was game three against Spassky because I think Fisher forfeited game two.
Yeah.
Just didn't show up. And, you know, he kept, oh, I don't want these cameras, or I want to go in this other room, and I want to be hidden, and you guys are trying to spy on me, and I don't like this, and then there's too much noise. And there was one point where where Spassky was finally just like, fuck, I give up, I don't know. And I think this arbiter, this Icelandic guy, just put his hands on them and just, like, sat them down and be like, play, you know, just fucking play already, you know? So it's getting around all that. And
that's my job.
Your job is to push everyone down and go, just play.
Right.
Pretty close.
This is the thing you like to do. Remember, this is the thing you want to do.
Yeah.
But I think it's – I always talk about this idea of – I think this business exploits people's insecurities, but I think it also attracts a certain type of personality that might be a little more prone to being insecure, because as performers and artists, we're naturally sensitive people, because you would have to be in order to absorb and then re-express things into the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you balance those things?
Well, I mean, you do want to take advantage of someone's sensitivity because that's their instrument.
Sure.
And so I like to think that if I have any job at all, it's trying to create some atmosphere of safety in which it's allowed that you know you can go out on a limb, or you can be someplace where you're not being judged, but rather you're allowed to just be. Because I think only if you have a kind of relaxation that comes from feeling safe can you actually then do the work.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the idea that we are all seeking to fill some, you know, ache or hole that we think will be filled by the embrace of, you know, strangers is so messed up, and we're all somehow conspiring together to have that fiction that we're going to get this thing that we need from this process is dead wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you, I would assume you would agree.
It's always very strange when you're working with somebody who seems like perfectly well adjusted, has great boundaries. Like you're going like, this is odd. And you're talented too.
What's your deal?
Yeah. What's your deal? I don't know. It's interesting. I had like visual images of, you know, people all fleeing their hometowns to come join the circus of our business and me going like, oh yay, my people, you know? And then these odd things that we do, whether it's, you know, through, I don't know, exercises, class, scripted stuff, where we're playing with ideas and stories where it's all make-believe. I mean, we're just playing at this stuff.
And promiscuous.
Sure.
The idea that fantasy and the sort of contingency of lives, that you're going to live another life either in a character or in a moment, a chapter in another town with a group of people whom you didn't know until that moment and may never see again.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. That is actually a kind of it would appeal to a very particular group of people.
Absolutely. So, not exactly continuing on that, but still in the same area. I just think about you know, a successful rehearsal on some really, really dramatic piece where, you know, we're sitting there and going to the depths of something and howling at the moon or you know, going back and forth and afterwards like high-fiving each other. Like, what a strange exercise. Who else does that? Right? Put on the sad music. Let's go.
But it's so, you know, just – here, you know, I imagine to a degree this happens with acting, but just, you know, knowing that Bobby Fischer would sit over a board, play himself, play every, you know, in a chess game, there are, I think, probably more possible combinations of moves than there are atoms in the universe. And
right.
So I used to think that being introspective and being in your own head meant, oh, you have depth and you're smart and you're better. And now I think, you know, I think it's better sometimes to put that away and connect with the rest of the world, because I think your brain doesn't make the distinction between reality and just observation. So in your head, if you're just in your own head the whole time, I think your brain can start creeping into areas that are not necessarily real, but your brain doesn't know the difference. So how do you, just as we're sort of wrapping this up, how do you guys unplug?
Well, I mean, those of us who, you know, think that if you, let me start again. If your life is about trying to compress reality and you start to believe that the only thing interesting is life with all the boring bits edited out, you're headed down a very dangerous road. And I think at the beginning of my career, or a lot of our careers, we start to endow the experience with much too much importance. But as you get older, if you're lucky enough to connect to friends and family and have other things that validate you, you can approach the work with more detachment. It's a certain kind of Zen detachment. You don't work any less hard, but I don't think your entire self-regard and your entire self-worth is caught up
sure.
in this, its success or failure. And I think that's the hope of how to try to have that sort of duality in your life.
Did having kids help you with that?
Yeah, I think just to that same point, the sort of fuller and more balanced life. I mean, I'm always, you know, trying to figure that out and make adjustments to that, and also, you know, give the proper amount of work and attention to the project in front of me. Which there is, I do think there's a. I don't have any particular concern about. Carrying it with me. I mean, the thing about Bobby Fischer, of course, is he's doing that day after day, week after week, year after year after year after year,
right.
where I work on a project for a number of months or maybe a year or two, but only really intensely for maybe 9 months. And then I am unplugging. So I'm not like fully immersed in any one thing for long enough that I feel there's any danger there.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, I know you guys have other chats that you have to have today. So I hope the junket day is kind to you. And I'm curious, what are your most asked questions? Like when you sit down and they're like, yeah. "Whoa, okay, Union," you're like, "Again?"
You know, how good am I at chess? Did I get better? Why did I want to play Bobby Fischer? What interests me about the story? I mean, they're reasonable enough questions.
Okay, they're reasonable.
Yeah.
But you got the answer.
Sometimes I think the best performance is taking place in the room when you have to act as if it's the first time you've been asked that question.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, it's fun. It's fun to watch. I can't remember who else said that they add like, that's interesting. Like they try to add like little things. Oh, that, even though you just got asked like 30 times.
Oh, that is a good question.
Oh, chess. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I guess you would want to know that. Well, fuck you. And then you just like rip the mic off and kick the camera over. But it was really nice chatting with you guys. And it's nice to see you and congratulations. And I'm so glad
Thank you. You too.
I'm so glad that you're sobriety and choices and one foot in front of the other have led to such amazing work and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks, too. Guys. Is this September 18th this comes out?
16th in New York and LA, and then 18th a lot of other places.
Okay, great. Pawn Sacrifice, great. Ed Zwick, Toby Maguire. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. That's how we end the show.
Okay.
Okay. So, I thought you were about to give me a burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.